As I say, my name's Martin Roberts. Please call me Martin. I'm what they call an ordained local minister. That means that I am not in charge of a parish. I'm not a vicar. I am part of a ministry team at St. John's in Woodbridge, which is an, let's get the labels in here, it would be called an evangelical charismatic church. But I think it'd be useful if you knew a bit about my background as I approach this quite potentially difficult subject. I was brought up, I went to boarding school because my father was in the army, and I was, the places I went had a sort of nominal Anglican background, although my secondary school was originally set up by a Baptist missioner from London to the hop pickers in Kent. And at school I was confirmed, and but then as I studied geology as it got older, I found myself becoming probably an evangelical atheist. And during my early time at university, that was very much my line. But whilst I was at university, I decided to take a year out, partly to avoid being in college when my girlfriend, well, my ex-girlfriend was coming back to college after she had had a year out. And during that time, I actually had a week's break between going up to Manchester and leaving university. So I spent it with a week with some Christians who were building an outdoor centre to help young people experience the outdoors and also something of God. And whilst I helped them build, they lent me a book called The Cross and Switchblade, which you may well have heard of, very sort of 1950s, 1960s book about a man who was called by God to work amongst the gangs in New York. And the conclusion I came was either he was lying or there was a God. And it didn't seem likely that a man would write a book based on lies. So at that point, depending on who I'm talking to, I'd say I came back to Christ. I happened to be at that stage in a Pentecostal church. So because I was in a Pentecostal church in Manchester, they encouraged me to be baptized because they didn't recognize my original baptism as a child. So I was dunked as an adult. And I carried on in a Pentecostal church when I went back to university. Eventually, I had quite a traumatic time, and I've struggled with depression quite a lot in my life, and but only probably recognized in the last few years. And as I traveled, I eventually ended up in another Pentecostal church in London, a very large church, and I have to admit I only went for social reasons at that stage. Even though I was a Christian, I was really struggling with my faith. And I only really went because there was a pretty girl there who I liked very much. But amazingly, God used a friend of mine, a man who became a friend, to really touch my life and changed it quite a lot. I eventually got married. And when we first moved to Abergavenny, where we were living in South Wales, we didn't really know where to go to church. So we went to the Pentecostal church first of all, because that's where we had a background. And almost before I'd got through the door, they asked if we preached, which was very off-putting. It was sort of the sense that actually wanted you for what you did rather than who you were. We never went back there. Eventually, we ended up in a charismatic Anglo-Catholic church. The first time we went there, they were walking around the church, carrying a statue of Mary, swinging incense, and we walked out. But the reason we went back was because we heard the preacher, the minister there, the vicar, speak, and he had such a heart for the gospel and for actually the fact that people could come to a believing faith and a relationship with Jesus, that we actually went back there. Within 6 months, I was swinging the incense. Anyway, so I've been in the Anglican church since then, and I have three children. my eldest boy was 18 this week, and about probably when I was just coming up to 40, we had this option of going forward for ministry, and it's an option by which I could remain I was working for BT at the time as a computer programmer and designer, software designer, and I could remain in that and still study for the ministry. So I studied for about 4.5 years part-time to do that, and was ordained just over, well, it's two and a half years ago, as a deacon priested just 18 months ago. I currently look after a congregation. My church is about 300 odd strong, and we split the morning service into two services, and we actually try and have them as congregations so that there is a pastoral oversight of people. We encourage people to be fairly fixed in which one they come to. So that's my background. A few years ago, I went to Poland. Whilst in Krakow, we visited the main cathedral, and I was very struck by a sign in the beginning of as we went into the cathedral. It says, "Don't just come here to look, come here to pray." I don't know if you've been to St. Paul's Cathedral recently, because you'll walk through a pair of glass doors and you'll join a queue to pay £8 something, or possibly nearly a tenner, to go in. The last time I went, I don't know whether I was wearing my collar, but I was absolutely furious, and I just walked straight past the line and straight in and refused to pay. I just thought, this is just awful. And as I walked out, eventually, you walk past these glass doors, and on the glass doors is etched, "Could these be the doors to heaven?" And I just found that really just made my blood boil. So the difference between what I'd seen in the Catholic church cathedral in Krakow, where the emphasis was this is a house of prayer, compared with what I was experiencing in London, where there is a desire to keep the building up before recognizing that it's a house of prayer. Whilst I was in that church, the cathedral in Krakow, I just had this sense that God was saying to me somehow I would be used to bridge between the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church. No idea what that meant. I had no idea. I'm currently unemployed. I took redundancy from BT in September. I had hoped to go into the Anglican ministry full time, but they turned me down. And currently, I was going to apply for a job with my local church, but that didn't seem appropriate. So now I'm unemployed. So I find myself talking to a bunch of Catholics, and I find very privileged to do so. So when I spoke to Magdalene about what to talk about, I have a passion for the Book of Romans. Maybe that's appropriate too. And we talked about that because the Book of Romans was written to a divided church. There were Jews and there were Gentiles. And the first part of the book is all about bringing them down to the same level, recognizing what they shared. And as a result of sharing that with Magdalene, she said, "Well, why didn't you talk about Paul and the divided church?" Thanks, Magdalene. So here's this sort of talk about it. Paul was a man acquainted with conflict, a Pharisee. So he spent most of his life arguing, most of his life debating, discussing the minutiae of doctrine, of belief. He probably argued long and hard about the resurrection with the Sadducees. And there's probably a loose agreement to disagree amongst those two as they shared some kind of power within the Jewish faith. There's no evidence that he actually met Jesus whilst Jesus was alive. But we know from the scriptures that the Pharisees were sent out by the central authorities to question him. And that was a perfectly legitimate thing to do. It was done with no agenda. It was done because whenever anybody, a rabbi, started preaching, there was a sense in which the central authorities sent to check them out. A bit like I had to get permission from my bishop to come and speak here today. We know that fairly early on in the New Testament church, Paul was involved in that conflict. We see him first as Saul, standing with the coats being laid at his feet while Stephen is stoned. To all intents and purposes, Paul is a murderer. He then went further to try and disorganize and to try and disrupt the spread of the church. Because as the persecution came into the Jerusalem church, the church started to spread. So we see him traveling to Damascus, where he has this amazing experience where he is suddenly brought low and somehow brought face to face, brought into a challenge by Jesus. He was fairly single-minded as an individual. We could see that by the way he persecuted the church, but we can also see that in his ministry as he goes on. And that was despite the fact that when, I think it's when the Spirit speaks to Ananias to go and anoint, go and pray with Paul so that he would regain his sight in Damascus, Ananias is told that Paul has been shown what he must be afflicted, the affliction, the suffering he would undertake, that would be done to him. So despite knowing that suffering, he becomes very single-minded. And we see that he actually goes into Arabia for 3 years. It's just referenced at one stage that he disappears. Not quite sure how that works out. But he did go and spend some time away. And it is during that time that his views and his gospel was actually developed. He came back, shared that with the central church in Jerusalem, and it is because of what his calling to the Gentiles that eventually he's sent out, and he goes to Antioch, which is not far from where he was originally in Tarsus. So we find that he is a man, so he's effectively sent somewhere, he joins a church, and we don't know really what he's doing. He probably we read later that he might well have been a tent maker, not quite sure what that actually means, a canvas worker or whatever. But whilst he's there, Peter came from the central church and spent some time fellowshipping with him. And whilst Peter was there with Paul and the Gentile church, he was quite happy to eat with the Gentiles in a Gentile fashion, to eat meat and to eat how they did and not actually perform any of the ritual washings, etc., that were part of the Jewish way of life. But when some Jewish Christians came from Jerusalem, Peter separated himself from the Gentile Christians, and Paul challenged him about that. He challenged him and actually said, you can't do that. You can't be one thing whilst there's some people around and another thing whilst other people are around. Either these Gentiles are Christians or they're not. You've got to respect that. And so he has this barney with Peter. You see, Paul's approach and his whole underlying foundation is what he calls his gospel. He even goes to say at one point that if he came and he preached a different gospel, he should not be listened to. And what is his gospel? And that really underpins his view and how he dealt with division. and how he dealt with the various factions that were there. I think we sometimes, just before we look at that, we sometimes have a view that the New Testament church was somehow better than ours. We sometimes have a view, and there's certainly in the evangelical part, there's a desire to return to the New Testament church. But actually, if we read virtually every letter Paul writes, he's writing to people who are struggling with conflict, with division, with discussion about various doctrinal points, with things that were difficult. There's a sense in which our humanity and their humanity tended to get in the way of how they walked in their Christian lives. So whilst we might think and see the divisions very clearly, because perhaps they'd been given labels, they were still there right in the early days. And Paul challenged them consistently throughout his life, even to the point when he was in jail in Rome. He was still writing letters to people urging them to be faithful to the gospel. And then he gave them advice about other things. So what is his gospel? In the early chapters of Romans, he writes to this divided church. Probably not divided in a sense of clear lines drawn, but a church that was struggling between Jews who felt that somehow their Jewishness and their Christianity had some point. So for them, the fact that they were circumcised, or the men were circumcised, was important to them. The fact that they celebrated the feasts was important to them. But alongside them were Gentile Christians, Romans and Greeks, who obviously had no Jewish background. And there was this clash where the Jews were saying, or some of the Jews were saying to the Greek and to the Roman men, you must be circumcised. You can't be a Christian unless you experience that mark in your flesh. And Paul comes down very heavily on those Jewish Christians. In fact, in Philippians, he calls them dogs, mutilators of the flesh. He is very aggressive against them. He is so adamant that that is not what marks them out, because he talks about the circumcision of the heart, which I'm afraid, ladies, includes you as well as us men. There's a sense in which something about recognizing that Christianity is not about outward marks, but about an inward relationship, an inward change. He would have, and the way he does it is he makes it very clear to the Jewish Christians. He talks about how the Gentiles can actually look at the world and in some ways live according to the law by what they see in the world. The fact is they can somehow, if they live the law, even though they're not under the law, it is somehow credited to them. So if they're good to each other, if they love their neighbour, if they experience and recognize other people as being made in God's image, somehow that's okay. And so he somehow knocks the Jews by saying, you can't look at these Gentiles, you can't look down on these Gentiles in any way. And then he looks at the Gentiles and he knocks them and says, well, actually, you guys lived a pretty rotten life. You actually were, sinners in a way which perhaps builds the Jews up. So you get this sort of challenge where he knocks them both. And then he goes back to something which is really important for, and I think is really important for us all as Christians to look at. He goes back to Abraham. Now, why does he go back to Abraham? The reason he goes back to Abraham is Abraham was given a promise that he would be the father of nations before Moses was given the law, before Israel was chosen as a people. At the point of receiving that promise, God says something amazing. He says that the fact that Abraham, or as he was at the time, Abram, believed that God could do this, even though he was in his 90s and his wife was well beyond childbearing age. Even though that was the case, he believed that that could happen. And it was credited to Abraham, or Abram, as righteousness. As a result of that, Abraham was circumcised. And in fact, so were all his household, poor then. So we see that the receiving of righteousness, the receiving of, and what do I mean by righteousness? Let's get clear about that. The righteousness is actually a bringing together of one person with God in a right relationship. It is a removal of that barrier between us and God that was placed there by the fall. It is a complete removal of that barrier. That's what righteousness means. And you see, it wasn't given to Abraham through anything he did. It's not because he did well, because actually we find out he then went on and messed up big time. His wife suggested, well, why don't you sleep with one of my servants and have a child by then? And then we can make him our heir. So we have Ishmael born. And eventually, Ishmael is sent away with Hagar. And in fact, Ishmael is blessed by God in a way that he would not in any way be persecuted. But then we find eventually Isaac is born, the child of the promise. But that's even after Abraham has really messed up big time in other ways. They end up in Egypt. And Pharaoh really likes the look of Abraham's wife. And there's a suggestion that actually Abraham denies that Sarah is his wife. And there's a risk that actually Sarah would end up being taken by Pharaoh as his wife. So Abraham is no... So after this amazing being credited with righteousness, he still messes up. That's important for us who always mess up to recognize. So by going back to Abraham, Paul lays a foundation of righteousness through faith. And that is Paul's gospel. He makes it very clear that we're all sinners. No one comes close to God. No one can do that. But he then says, because of what Jesus did on the cross, that righteousness that he obtained on the cross can be credited to our account. Not because of anything we have done or anything we will do, but because of what Jesus has done. And it is from that basis that he starts. And again, in Romans, Paul then levels everybody again because he talks about baptism. He talks about how, and probably in, there are three chapters in Romans, Romans 6, Romans 7, Romans 8, which are probably the Everest of the New Testament. They talk about, in Romans 6, he talks about, we have died with Christ in our baptism, and because we have died, we will be raised with him in the resurrection. That is written in the past tense. It's not, there's an awful lot, I haven't really experienced much Catholic preaching, but certainly where I come from, the sort of tradition I'm in, there's lots of talk about, oh well, in the Greek it says, and they often it says about things, it talks about things being in a tense as the continuous presence, ongoing. There's a sense of ongoing, and quite often that's the tense that gets described to us. So when it talks about stand in your faith, there's a sense in which it's an ongoing standing that you must do. When it talks about work out your salvation with fear and trembling, there's a sense in which it's an ongoing thing. But in here, Paul is very clear. He uses the past tense. He describes our death, or our being in the death of Christ in the past tense, once and for all. And as a result of our dying with Christ on the cross, we also died to the law, which was really crucial for him to bring the Jewish Christians to understand that it wasn't a taking away of the law, it was a fulfillment of the law. Paul never knocks the law in terms of saying it was useless. He said, but without the law, how would I have known I'm a sinner? And there's a good example that he uses. He uses the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. Now he uses that one because mainly that one is about our thoughts. Isn't it our thoughts that condemn us most? Isn't our thoughts that start first and then lead to sin? It's our thought life that often is the thing where we struggle most. And then once we struggled in our thought process, then it comes out. So whether it be a bitter relationship, or whether it be lust, or whether it be bitterness or anger or whatever, quite often it is thoughts that then lead on to actions. So he uses covetousness. He says, how would I have known I was covetous? I was coveting something unless there was a law that said thou shalt not covet. So he says the law is good, but actually it is fulfilled in the death and resurrection of Jesus. And as a result of that, I'm no longer under the law, I'm under the Spirit. So, and he uses the idea that when a person is married and their spouse dies, or before then, there's a tie of the law. But when their spouse dies, that idea that that spouse could now remarry and not be an adulterous relationship, because they have died. There is a sense in which what was there has been finished. And so the sense that a widow could remarry was not a problem, because in the law's eyes, that original relationship, that original covenant had been broken. And in the same way, because we died, the original covenant has been broken. We are now under a new covenant. But then Paul, in chapter 7 of Romans, he struggles. He talks about, I do the things I don't want to do, and I can't do the things I want to do. How true is that for us? We would love to pray more. We'd love to be more loving. We'd love to have the right words to say at the right time. We would love to be able to do those things which actually would build people up rather than pull them down. But we find ourselves doing exactly the opposite. We do those things that damage us rather than help us. We do those things that hurt rather than build up. And he goes on in chapter 8, and I really would encourage you to read chapter 8 of Romans in its entirety. It's a chapter which expresses how it is through Jesus and through the Spirit that we are brought up, that we have been given life. So that's the gospel. You can see that Paul is passionate about that. Romans is not an easy letter to read, but it is, you can see in it, a passion of bringing people together. He knows some of them, but he's never been there. So he's writing to a community he doesn't actually know very much about. It would be like you writing to a church that maybe you wanted to visit, but they're coming. So it seems odd that he talks about this division, but he wants them to know that there's a gospel of faith and a salvation through faith which underpins everything that he's talking about. And it's only that he can turn his back on his own past life, on his murderous background, and know that actually God loves him. Towards the end of Romans, he tackles some other divisive things. And I want you to understand that there is two types of division here. There's a division that he saw that was between people who challenged this basis of the gospel through faith, and then there was a division caused by how that was worked out. how that was expressed. And those are two different things. One of the experiences I had when I was outside the church was I looked at all the various denominations and I saw division. But when I became a Christian, I didn't see those divisions. I found actually there was much more in common with people of faith than actually that divided them. Yes, we had arguments about full immersion baptism, or we had discussions about the sacraments. But actually, there was much more in common between people of faith than actually the world sees. They see the labels, but actually on the inside, a lot of us have a lot more in common because we are people of faith. We're people who actually want to follow what Jesus did, and we want to know Jesus in our life now. We don't just want to walk around doing pious things for the sake of it. We want to experience God's life in our own lives. And that's what being a Christian is about. It's about experiencing God's relationship, about the removal of that barrier. On the Alpha course, Nicky Gumbel uses an example. He says, if that is me, that's us, and that's our sins. There is a barrier between us and God, our sin. But Jesus was different. See, Jesus, there was no barrier between him and God, because there was no sin. But on the cross, he became sin for us, that there need be no barrier between us and God. So he became sin for us. And when you see on the cross, he talks about, you know, why have you forsaken me? Because there, for a time, there was a barrier between him and his Father. But he destroyed those sins. He took those sins so he could restore us to a relationship where there is no barrier between us and God. So that's what's important to Paul. That's the gospel. But he talks in the end of the letter to the Romans, he starts talking about things like special days. St. Patrick's Day. He starts talking about differences between the way they live their lives. So we find that there were some Christians who ate meat and some who wouldn't. Now the reason there was an issue about that is virtually all the butchers at the time were linked to some form of idol worship. So an animal would be sacrificed to some form of idol, and as a result of that, then the meat would be sold. So if you ate meat, there could be some kind of understanding that you were somehow paying some kind of homage to the idol. So the idea that we're actually, some people felt, well, I can eat this meat because I know the idol's just an idol, it's not God, so I can eat the meat quite happily. But then other people found that for them, that wasn't right, so they found themselves eating just vegetables. And Paul made very clear that neither party should look down on each other. Neither party should look at each other and say, that's not right. So here we have a division between people caused by the way they are working faith out. And Paul's advice is, if you feel you are strong and there is a weak brother, weak sister, it is your responsibility as the stronger to bow to the weaker and to support and encourage them. So if that meant you not eating meat because it was actually the way to encourage your weaker brethren, then that is what you should do. Likewise, if drinking alcohol causes people to struggle in their faith and the way they work it out, well then it's better not to drink alcohol. In my experience, if people felt it was right to swing incense as part of the service, then it was better for me to be involved in that if it built a bridge than it was for me to look down on it. I found that the experience of swinging incense, I always smiled. I found it very difficult to stand very close to somebody and waft incense in their face without smiling, and they would smile back. But what I found was, in that church where we were, there were two congregations. There were those who were very Anglo-Catholic. I don't know if you understand these labels, the idea of a sort of a Anglican who has Catholic understanding, and very evangelical, charismatic people, we were worshipping together. But what happened was, in reaction to, and not just because of me, but part of what happened, as a result of somebody coming from one side doing something that the others appreciated, suddenly we found conversations going, changing. There was a lady in the church who was such a tutter, do you know what I mean? Everything we did, everything that went on, there was a moan. And it was written on her face. You could see the tension on her face. About 3 years after we were there, Thelma somehow clicked. Somehow faith came into her life. And her face physically changed. Within weeks, when my wife had her first child, my boy is now 18, she arranged for a friend of hers to knit a little man, which she gave to my son for Christmas. There was no way that before she experienced faith that she would have ever done that. But somehow the barriers between us came down, and it was beautiful. She actually renewed her baptism vows in the river. She was 80-something. Sometimes these divisions are about how we work out our faith and not about the underlying faith. And Paul makes it very clear, don't let any of those things come between us. Do not let the way we work out our faith be a barrier. We are duty bound to look at how we work out our faith and actually to see where we could actually reduce the barriers. Paul wanted us to overlook and wants us to overlook other people's failings. He wants us to love them. There were three commands effectively Jesus gave us. He told us, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength, with all your mind, and something else. Strength gone. And love your neighbour as yourself. And the other one he said is, love one another as I have loved you. One of the prayers that Jesus prayed is still unanswered. He prayed in John chapter 17, let them be one as you and I are one. Well, we're not, are we? Let's face it, we are divided. How are we divided? Are we divided by how we work out our Christian life, or are we divided by our underlying faith? There's a difference. And that's only a question that you and I can look inside at, because I don't think you should allow somebody else to judge what your faith is and how it is. When anybody comes and speaks, you must apply the so what test. The so what test is, well, so what? You can talk about Paul and what Paul suggested, but so what? What is it about? What's it going to do for us? How are we going to be different today from going forward? That is really important. It applies when your local priest speaks in the church there, or when my vicar speaks in my church, or whenever I hear, there is a so what test. Otherwise, it's just words. I'm now going to talk about something controversial. I'm going to talk about the Mass, the Eucharist, communion. One of the things that pains me most as I have walked through the Christian faith, why is it that this supper, this act done at the Last Supper, has become so divisive? Why is it that somehow this simple act performed with the people he loved, including Judas, has actually become the thing over which we're divided? It pains me. I want you to know that. I want you to know that is not something I take lightly. I understand and I respect where you may be coming from. I don't necessarily know that. I know I've got into trouble before. When I was a Pentecostal, they really had a very anti-Roman Catholic view, and actually were quite aggressive towards Roman Catholics, and particularly over the communion. But I knew that I actually had a discussion with a lady about it, and got into all sorts of trouble, because quite often what they say at the centre, the people on the outside don't actually follow. So I understand that. So I come from a church which uses and probably has these things, the 39 articles. I actually looked them up on the web. In some ways, please don't, because they are really aggressive towards the Roman Catholic Church, and it pains me. It made me want to actually write to the Archbishop and say, isn't it about time that we looked at these and actually removed some of them? Isn't it about time that we actually challenged them? And the reason why I feel we can challenge them is because what some of them say, we find that quite a large number of the people in our church actually support. So quite a lot of the things that they're talking against, they support. So I find I belong to a church which has both ends of the spectrum. We have people who believe communion is about a real absence, it's just a memorial meal. And we have people at the other end of the spectrum who believe that there's a real presence, that at the act of consecration, the bread and the wine become the body and blood in substance. So we have both sides of the spectrum. Yet somehow we belong to the same church. Yet somehow the idea of the real presence in terms of full, and let's use the technical words, transubstantiation, is seen in a very negative sense if you read the 39 articles. Why bring this divisive subject up? I have debated on my way here whether I should even talk about it. I wanted to join you for Mass today. But when I spoke to Magdalene, she said, well, as long as you take your collar off. Now, I don't blame you for saying that. Because it just shows in some ways how much the hurt between the two are. And there's so much history, isn't there? Paul uses a phrase in Philippians, which I think is really important. Forgetting what is past, I press on to that for which I have, he took hold of me. So it's about a calling, it's about moving forward. I believe, and where I'm coming from, see, when I do communion, the first time I took communion, we had this table. And because I come from an evangelical, charismatic, nobody said what I was supposed to do with my hands when I'm doing the communion and saying the prayer. So I'm holding the bottom of this table, not really sure what to do with my hands, because nobody taught me. Likewise, I went to another friend of mine who was priested at the same time, but he's an Anglo-Catholic. He's actually the curate of the other local church in the town. His first Mass, he's struggled, so he gets sweats an awful lot. So the whole time, about every other sentence, there was a hand appeared and mopped his brow. And there was something lovely about the support that they gave him. And the fact